You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lachlan Balfour tōku ingoa. Nō mai, haere mai, ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Monday Wire for Rahina, Monday the 1st of July. I'm Lachlan, your host, filling in for Jemima, who's having a well-deserved break, and I'm here with producer Izzy. Izzy, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. And yourself?
I'm pretty good, yeah. I'm enjoying this. The weather's improved a wee bit. Well, I suppose it's good weather, just cold.
Yeah, as always, it is winter, so yeah, that does tend to happen.
Not helped by the large window we have in the studio, letting all the cold air in.
Exactly.
But we have a great show for you today. First up, Izzy speaks with Tova O'Brien about trust in the media. Southern Cross is back for another week where we talk about events across the Pacific. Associate Professor Stephen Hoadley then joins us to discuss New Zealand's relationship with Israel and the United Nations Relief Works Agency. And finally, Ricardo Menendez March from Auckland Action Against Poverty talks about the government's new housing standards and their effect on Housing New Zealand tenants. Kia hao, whakaaro. If you have any thoughts to share throughout the show, we would love to hear from you. Tuku pātū mai, send through a text to 5395, or why am I? You can call the studio to chat with one of us on 309 3879. Tukua te puti ki te pai te ho. Don't forget to vote in our Twitter poll. Izzy, do you have that poll up?
Do I have the poll? I do not.
You do not,
but
okay.
I can get that poll.
I have it. Here we go. So it's, if you were a tenant in an uninsulated home, would you report your landlord for not complying with the government's new healthy home standards, and why or why not? We've had quite a few replies there, pretty mixed. But yeah, get voted on that at 95BFM News on Twitter or give us a text, 5395. You know, maybe you're a tenant in an uninsulated home. You would be feeling the cold right now. Anyway, should we get into The Wire?
I think that's a fantastic idea.
Well, hey.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Over the weekend, I attended the Otago Foreign Policy School in Dunedin. Tova O'Brien from News Hub was one of the speakers, and her talk focused on trust in the media. Today, I spoke with her about this topic. We discuss the factors that influence public trust, the impact of social media, and how journalists can continue working to instill trust in the media and wider institutions. I began by asking her what the current level of trust in the media is.
They're nudging up slightly, which is really positive. So there is a bit of a nudge up in terms of trust in media and government in that Edelman Trust Survey. So that's a global communications company that does a kind of trust barometer every year around the world, looking at people's trust in various institutions. So they have nudged up slightly, but trust in government and media are still, they're still the most mistrusted institutions that are recorded in that survey. So there's still a lot of work to do.
So with that nudge up that's occurred, do you know any kind of factors that might have impacted that, or is the nudge reasonably insignificant?
I think that there's been a bit of a backlash on social media and the kind of post-truth world, people being so emotive, driving arguments with emotion rather than facts, undermining experts, undermining traditional media. So I think there has been a bit of a backlash, and that same Edelman Trust survey also said that people are returning to traditional media and seeking out reliable sources of news because there is that kind of increasing distrust in social media. So I suspect that that plays a role. 73% of people in that survey are worried that false information or fake news could be weaponised, so they are getting wise to that idea, if you like.
Yeah, and there's a link, clearly, between trust in media and wider institutions, such as the government. So when the government attacks media, what's the effect on not only trust levels, but also people's perceptions?
It's hugely, hugely problematic, especially when governments do it, because I think it validates those fringe ideas. So we've seen it in the extremes in the United States with Donald Trump constantly accusing the media of being fake media, undermining any reporting that he doesn't like or that doesn't sit with his view of the world. And so too in New Zealand, at a much lesser level. We've seen it from the Prime Minister and also the Leader of the Opposition, both Jacinda Ardern and Simon Bridges, have just small pointed digs at the media that serve to undermine them. So Simon Bridges saying, when I interviewed him, for example, on News Hub Nation, that I won't like certain views about something, simply not true. Jacinda Ardern telling a group of school children in Christchurch, high school children, just to tolerate the media, to ignore the media, that she has to tolerate them, this kind of thing. It just serves to incrementally undermine traditional news media, and when politicians do it especially, it validates those views.
So has there historically been government targeting of the media? And if so, is it mainly just more problematic today because of our current political climate?
Yeah, good point. I think probably it has been something that's existed since time immemorial. Politicians are often going to disagree with journalists. But I think with social media, the fact that we are bombarded by accusations of fake news, it is a stick, a bludgeon that is being used to undermine journalism, especially journalism that you don't agree with. I think that there's more responsibility on governments, on politicians, to take a different view and to actually try and prop up the thought, the state, not undermine it, even if you don't agree with those opinions. So I think it probably has been an issue that's been around for a long time, but I think it's been exacerbated quite the same way as it is now, and this is something that we're kind of grappling with. Politicians and journalists are grappling with in a way that we haven't before.
Given that the purpose of the media is really to inform the public and keep people aware of issues of the day, why do audiences often feeling as though there's emphasis on entertainment and clicks? So how widespread of a problem do you think this is in New Zealand, and has mainstream news organisations being active on social media perhaps contributed to this feeling of entertainment?
Yeah, interesting point. Robert Peston, who's ITV's political editor in the United Kingdom, talks a bit about this. He wrote a book called WTF in the Wake of Brexit, and he discusses this. So he talks about, he's a massive brain, this guy, and he'll write a long-winded think piece on economic policy, and it will get very little engagement, whereas he can take to Twitter and write a contentious, as he did, write a contentious tweet about the US president after the election, and that will get hundreds of thousands of likes and engagements. And he said that that's quite intoxicating, you know, as a journalist, to kind of get that type of feedback. But I also think you can walk and chew gum at the same time, and media organisations likewise can walk and chew gum at the same time. So you can offer varying degrees of journalism. You can have a bit of that entertainment-based stuff that people want to read. You can also, as journalists, pursue the truth, do longer, more contextualised pieces as well. And I think that there's a market for both.
Following on a bit from your earlier points around social media and fake news proliferating, given the globalised world that we do live in, with many leaders talking about alternative facts, and which there is obviously no such thing, as well as fake news, how has this impacted New Zealanders in particular?
I think in New Zealand it's probably not as extreme as we've perhaps seen in the United States and United Kingdom, but I think just generally that pernicious kind of constant undermining of journalism and traditional media serves the same purpose, right? So what we were talking about earlier as well with politicians who undermine the media, I think it serves the same purpose here. And it just offers people, and again, this, I cited a couple of studies at the Foreign Policy School, which are older studies, and this was a problem then, that the undermining of media, conservative politicians especially, choosing to kind of to take down a journalist's views if they don't agree with an opinion. So I think fake news and alternative facts have probably just exacerbated those problems that we've been talking about. You know, so the more people there are rallying cries against journalism and its validity, the harder it is for journalists to do their job, which ultimately is to seek truth.
And just following on from the proliferation of social media, we're starting to have things such as deep fakes becoming more common, in which this technology can completely fabricate someone in any situation, which is almost the ultimate fake news. So do you have any thoughts on how government or media institutions can deal with this?
Governments, I'm not sure, and I think that will probably form a part of the debate that we are having and that we're going to continue to have, and that I think will be ramped up around freedom of expression versus hate speech and the like, and promulgating fake news and things. In terms of journalism, I think the conclusion of that, the speech I did yesterday at Otago, was basically journalism needs to go back to the basic tenets of journalism, truth, accuracy, fairness, independence, accountability and humanity. And if we continue to be the people providing that information in that context, then hopefully that will fortify the role of the media and the role of the fourth estate. But it's deeply problematic, especially when people are using Photoshop or editing software to create absolute false narratives, and that being picked up. Another thing we can do as journalists, and we have done, is hold those people to account who are doing it. So especially politicians, if they share fake news, which Judith Collins has once on Twitter before, making sure we put that to her, question her motives, why is she doing that, and bring that to the public. So I think if we fortify ourselves and make sure that we continue to play the role that we've promised to serve the public, if we continue doing that, guided by the ethics and tenets that we've signed up to, I think that can help reinforce journalism and hopefully more people, as we're starting to see in those trends in the Edelman Trust survey, we'll see more people coming back to traditional media.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Yes, that was Tova O'Brien talking about trust in the media with Izzy. After the break, we're going to be joined by the Southern Cross team to talk about what's going on in the Pacific. But for now, here is Did You Feel Me Slip Away by B1991.
The reserve forms never stick around a long time. I am kind of quiet. The reserve forms never stick around. We'll be right back.
How do you impart a lifelong love of discovery with a 15-second ad? The Science Roadshow is at MOTAT this school holidays. Chock-a-full with interactive exhibits and two live shows.
That'll do it.
July 6th to the 21st. Normal MOTAT admission fees apply.
Well, my name is Chris, and I'm here to say, looking for a flatmate in the Linnet's Grey. You gotta be cool, and you gotta be tough. You gotta be vegan, and no pets or smokers.
Room in Freeman's Bay Cottage. Me, urban sophisticated wine expert, French cinema aficionado. You, educated, tidy, silent.
Room in flat, Mount Eden. Text Dave.
Whoever or wherever you're after, the 95BFM Accommodation Guide is here for you. Email your listing to accommodationguide@95bfm.com. The 95BFM Accommodation Guide, every Thursday on drive and online at 95bfm.com.
Now it's time for the Southern Cross.
Yes, Southern Cross is back, and with me in the studio today is Pacific Media Centre Director, Professor David Robey, who is talking with us about both good and bad news for Pacific journalists, and also the technologies of fake news and artificial intelligence at an Asia Pacific Media Conference. So, David, the good news or the bad news first?
Well, I guess we'll just start with the bad news and maybe hopefully get a little bit better as we go along.
So, a journalist who was reported missing 22 years ago in Tahiti.
Yeah.
Some murder charges have been laid.
This is a really murky story. It's gone on for, you know, for so long now. Jean-Pascal Corot is his name, now murder charges have been laid against two people who are quite prominent in the territorial government, which is quite extraordinary turnaround. There have been charges laid before. Back in 2004, there was speculation that Gaston Flosse was then president at the time, and JPK, as the journalist was always known, was investigating corruption and so on, and that's when he disappeared. And so the theory was that it was actually secret agents operating for Gaston Flosse's government that did it. And then the murder charges in that case were sort of dropped later on. And so now this is a new turnaround. So the saga goes on.
Yeah, and I mean, when this first happened in 1997, was this pretty big news?
Oh, well, it was, and it has been, you know, big news and sporadic, over the years. I had the good fortune to meet him way back when he was editor on Les Nouvelles in Tahiti, and even then he had a big reputation as probably the best investigative journalist in Tahiti.
So we may never know really truly what happened. Are you hopeful that this might shed a bit more light, though?
Hopefully it'll sort of get somewhere close to the truth. But you know, even the previous rumours were that he was murdered and dumped at sea and with concrete around his legs and things like . But this one, there's been very little actual information about the charges have been laid. But the two people accused are actually free at the moment. So that's quite remarkable, I think.
Yeah. Well, look forward to following that one. Now for some good news. Ben Bohan has won $10,000 Bougainville Mission Grant for Pacific Journalism. Talk about this a bit.
Yeah. Well, Ben's quite, he's sort of like a minor celebrity right across the Pacific. He's an Australian, but he's been based in Vanuatu. That's been his home for probably the best part of two decades. And he's, as a photojournalist, he's pretty well been to every major conflict in the Pacific. And he covered the Bougainville War initially for the 10 years. He's been East Timor, covered the conflict there. So he's been all over the place, and he's got amazing library of photographs that he's accumulated over the years. And so most news agencies go to him when they want good pictures of what's happening. And this is a new grant. It's from the Walkley Foundation in Australia, the Sean Dorney grant, and it's a tribute to Sean Dorney, who is also pretty well a real celebrated journalist right across the Pacific. He's retired now, but people wanted to sort of really boost a legacy for him. And so this is is the first award that's been made under this this new grant. And what Ben will be doing, we've had quite a bit to do with him over the years. He's we've published some of his portfolios and so on. But he's going to be going to back to Bougainville in October this year when the referendum on independence is going to take place. So he'll be reporting for quite a wide variety of media, including us at the time.
Great. I mean, are there many sort of grants like this that, that help journalists that especially work in the Pacific?
No, this is the first of its kind. And so everybody's sort of really jumping up and down, really delighted that this is happening and such a good awardee, you know, for the first time. And that would probably be a similar sort of grant each year like that.
Wow. Very good, very good. Now, you have just come back last week after what we gather was a really interesting Asia-Pacific conference on humanism. What does that mean and what was it all about?
Well, I guess it's sort of like it was a revival of that term, but in a sort of modern context, bringing in some humanity into communications and media in this age of, you know, fake news and very vitriolic denunciations of the media and journalists and so on. So a lot of the research sort of really focused around that. But I found it really quite disturbing, actually, and so some of the things that came up. And one of the highlights for me was an Egyptian cyber crime expert who's a UN consultant for an agency that operates around drugs and crime. And he was giving a demonstration about really some of the techniques that are actually used for surveillance. And I mean, a lot of us know, you know, surveillance is pretty bad, but he was actually demonstrating with just a lot of the tools that are available now on the internet. And he said, you know, this is just what's available publicly. Imagine what the military have got available at their fingertips and so on. And so his demo, if you like, was quite disturbing. And he actually did two sessions, and one of the previous ones was about facial recognition, but the way that the technology is fairly, you know, pretty all coming in now about distorting people's voices and images so that you can basically have politicians saying things they never said. And the implications for this, you know, for media research and for the media itself and that sort of thing. So it was a pretty challenging sort of conference.
Yeah, do you see these sort of technologies possibly having quite a negative effect in the future?
Absolutely, and I think that was the message that was coming from him and quite a few of the other speakers as well, that ethics, we've got to get ethics back into technology, that sometimes we just get carried away with, you know, technology. And he was saying that universities have to really step up to the mark and you know, lead some of the debate and it's that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I mean, following on a little bit from that, we've kind of been struggling with the big tech companies to actually get them to really monitor and regulate the type of activity there. So do you see that as another potential challenge?
Absolutely, and there were actually quite a few presentations around that, and you know, particularly some of the social media sites like Facebook and Twitter and all that sort of thing. So, you know, it was a pretty lively conference.
Yeah. Mm. And you also had a hand in four new books being launched at the conference. Tell us more about this. Four books.
Yeah, well, these are fairly wide-ranging books, but our one was a one called Science Writing and Climate Change, and it's really geared for journalists in the Asia-Pacific region. And it was a combination between Professor Crispin Maslog from Manila. He's a sort of like a doyen of communications research and journalism. And myself, and then there was a guy called Joel Adriano, who was from Sky for sort of a science development website. And so we combined together to produce this book. And hopefully it's going to be really helpful for journos in the region, and you know, it'll help to add to the debate around Pacific countries, in particular the front line of climate change.
I see more literature coming out about Pacific nations, especially because they are really feeling the effects of climate change. Are they more in focus than perhaps in the past?
Oh, yeah. I think that many of these small countries actually have quite a lot to show the rest of the world. and particularly as it's all about survival, and three countries really that threatened their future. So it's really a matter of trying to adapt as quickly as possible, you know, create a longer period that they can actually sort of stay in countries and so on. So there's much more debate now, and journalists right throughout the Pacific, it's you know, part of their sort of daily raison d'etre, if you like, whereas we're still a little bit detached from it here, I think, even in New Zealand, certainly in Australia.
And finally, what are some of the stories that Pacific Media Watch is working on at the moment?
Well, we've got, there's one that's actually just, we've been wondering about over this weekend. There was a helicopter that went missing. The last reports were on Friday afternoon. Indonesian military helicopter disappeared in West Papua. And of course, you know, there's a big conflict going on at the moment. There's been a lot of skirmishes in the last few months, and a lot of shooting, a lot of warfare that's actually been going on. But 12 people are on this helicopter. It lost radio contact just after it left its, Oxabil, which was taken off there, and it was heading for the capital, Jayapura, and the military airfield, which is Sentai, and nothing was further has been heard. There's been no reports about where it might be, or, you know, it was a crash or what. There's been some speculation on some of the West Papuan Freedom Movement Facebook, social media sites, that sort of thing, claiming that it's been shot down, and then they've got Indonesian military sources saying, no, it's all a hoax. But certainly in the context of what's been going on and the conflict, it's a bit of a worrying thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, if it were shot down, that would potentially exacerbate tensions.
Oh, absolutely, and we've got a few other stories on the boil as well. My colleague Michael, he actually interviewed Marissa Moisen today from West Papua, and she's pretty amazing person, a campaigner around deforestation and militarism and so on in the West Papua, and we're always keen to know what's happening in West Papua. It's a big priority for us on our Pacific Media Watch service.
Great.
Yeah. Just to follow on from that, she is speaking tonight at the St. Columba Centre at 6:30. So if anyone listening is keen to go and hear her speak, do go along. There's an event on Facebook, and I'm sure you can just search and it'll be found.
Great. Yeah. Yes.
Great.
Absolutely.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to hearing about those in the coming weeks. Thanks so much, David.
Right. Thanks. Thanks.
And you, of course, can read all the Pacific Media Centre updates at asiapacificreport.nz.
That was the Southern Cross.
Last week, we were joined by veteran activist John Minto from the Palestinian Solidarity Network to express his views on New Zealand's relationship with Israel, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, and issues around the right to return for Palestinian refugees cared for by the agency. UNRWA was set up following the Arab-Israeli War to care for the over 700,000 Palestinians displaced during the conflict. It now provides relief to over 5 million Palestinian refugees, which the agency defines as persons whose normal place of residence was Palestine during the period of 1 June 1946 to 15 May 1948, and who lost both home and means of livelihood as a result of the 1948 conflict. New Zealand recently increased their contribution to UNRWA by $1.5 million to provide care for those located largely in the Gaza Strip. This week, Associate Professor Stephen Hoadley from the University of Auckland Politics and International Relations Department spoke to us about New Zealand's relationship with Israel, UNRWA, and what repercussions this increased contribution might have on the relationship. I began by asking him what New Zealand's relationship with Israel is like.
It's even-handed, that's the word that's always used, even-handed between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, and when officials go to the one, they also make a point of going to the other.
How does Israel interact with New Zealand?
Very well. The relationship has, well, with a couple of exceptions, there have been a couple of rough places when a couple of Mossad agents came and they adopted the identity of a deceased New Zealander, and the New Zealand government was very incensed and expelled them. The Israeli ambassador withdrew from New Zealand for a period of time, and there was a good deal of aggro about fraudulent behavior and unacceptable espionage. All that is well in the past. I think that was about a decade ago. And as far as we can see, the relationship at the moment is quite a normal one.
And New Zealand has somewhat of a history of abstaining on many anti-Israel proposals at the United Nations. Does this affect the relationship at all?
Yes. Murray, one of the last things Murray McCulley did as Minister of Foreign Affairs was he, along with other governments, sponsored a resolution that in effect condemned the settlements, the Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And this was quite unacceptable to Israel. There was a time when I think the ambassador left the country and then had to be some negotiations to return. And this continues to be a bit of a sore point insofar as the Israeli government and as well some other New Zealand figures said the resolution was unbalanced because it didn't point out some of the acts of violence that Hamas and the PLO were committing against Israel. So that it remains a kind of point of contention that New Zealand opposes the settlements. They do support the two-state solution. They would oppose, I think, the current trend of the Netanyahu administration, assuming that it carries on, but of course we won't know that until the next election. And that, but it's certainly the issue of settlements is one that troubles the New Zealand government.
What's your opinion on the BDS movement?
Well, I've got in front of me this on the screen 18 things that the BDS movement did. Such as Airbnb has decided it wasn't going to do business with Israeli companies located on the West Bank. Lord, of course, pulled out of a concert, and a number of other entertainers did as well. Various legislators in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in Spain, and Portugal have condemned the settlements and called for arms embargo, and so on it goes. So it seems that if you look at this list, this is just the list for last year, that there has been a lot of BDS activity. But I've also got on the screen, and your listeners might like to also pull this up, a Brookings Institution analysis done on in January of last year, saying essentially in a nutshell, the Israeli government has been boycotted by Arab governments since it was founded. It has learned how to cope, and it does quiet business with many of those Arab governments that rhetorically condemn Israel, but in terms of technology exchange, in terms of trade, services, tourism, and other aspects, carry on business as usual with Israel, and that therefore the BDS movement hasn't really had a major effect. We had an Israeli Haaretz journalist here at the Writers' Festival last month, and he was quite robust in saying the Israeli economy has never been stronger. The growth rate is high. The number of partners that Israel has is at a historic high. The Trump administration, of course, has moved strongly in towards Israel and against the Palestinians, so that the BDS movement seems to have a pretty minor effect compared to all of those other developments.
Are we seeing any influence from the movement affecting New Zealand's relations with Israel?
Again, people divide on this. There'll be some who would say the BDS movement is actually counterproductive insofar as it drives Israeli businesses and enterprises out of the West Bank, which employ Palestinians, and therefore Palestinians actually are losing jobs and opportunities to upskill and to participate in modern economic production and sales. As far as the New Zealand government goes, the New Zealand government has not formally endorsed it that I know of. No major New Zealand institution like the University of Auckland, for example, unlike Leeds University, which has their academics have persuaded the university to divest its interests in Israel. No university in New Zealand has done that to my knowledge, although individual students, individual staff members do have their strong views and do participate in the BDS movement. So as far as we can see, it remains a sort of grassroots, voluntary, individualized association with the movement without a great deal of official sanction.
And moving on to Palestinian refugees, do they have a right to settle in Israel?
That is one of the big questions. You put your finger on that, like the status of East Jerusalem, for example. This is one of the hot-button issues. The Israeli government says no, that those who left voluntarily, although that's controversial too. Were they driven out, or did they leave? Were they induced to leave by fear-mongering by Arab governments? But in any case, they did leave, and the Israeli government doesn't want to accept the right of return, because if all of the descendants, so these are descendants, of course, from those who left in 1948, returned, then the Jewish population would be overwhelmed, the demography would be transformed, and it would no longer be a Jewish state. Some would say that might be a good thing. The Israelis do not agree. They deny that there is either a right or that it would be practical to readmit all of the descendants of those who left in 1948-49.
And the UNRWA deals with Palestinian refugees as a UN body. How does Israel view them?
Well, Israel views them very negatively, and the United States government does as well, and many other analysts view it very negatively as an over-bureaucratized welfare organization that perpetuates dependency. It allows the governments in which the Palestinians have settled to ignore their situation, to refuse to integrate them into their own societies, but rather to keep them in the refugee camps where they are fed and housed and otherwise looked after by the international community. That is, you and I, the taxpayer, and the taxpayers around the world through their governments support the Palestinians. That the criticism is that without holding out the prospect that they are still refugees, they will return. This prevents individual Palestinians from moving on in their careers, moving to other countries, undertaking normal careers, integrating into the societies into which they've moved, and that this creates then a fertile field for radicalism, for recruitment for those who would take up violence on behalf of Hamas or the PLO against Israel and work with other terrorist organizations. So there are lots of criticisms of the UNRWA episode. It doesn't look like it's going to change. There seems to be a consensus in the UN that it's too difficult to unpack or unpick and reform. So it carries on year after year in its present form. The fact that the United States has drastically reduced its aid to UNRWA may have some effect, and other governments may follow. So there may have to be some reform and belt tightening in that organization, and this may have some effect on the, 2 million Palestinians who are living under the welfare provisions that UNRWA makes available.
How did UNRWA come to exist?
It was voted on by the UN, the United Nations General Assembly, voted it and created as an affiliated organization of the United Nations, which it still is. and therefore it is part of the United Nations family, alongside a number of other organizations that look after women, children, weather, food, health, specialized organizations. And it's it works closely with the UN High Commission for Refugees. But from the Israeli view, it's a malign and malignant organization that's long outlived its usefulness, that in fact creates more negative consequences than positive consequences, and that it is long overdue for some sort of makeover, if not radical reform.
And this right to return, is this something Israel views as something that is totally off the table, or that sometime in the future they may look at it again?
As far as I can understand, the Israeli government sees it as totally off the table. Most Israelis also see it as totally off the table, except the 20% perhaps of the Arab population of Israel. And remember, there is a 20% of the population do have the vote. They have MPs in the Knesset. They have political parties. They have all the rights and freedoms and privileges that any Israeli has. So amongst that part of the Israeli population, there may be some sympathy for the right of return, but it's not very strongly voiced, and there have been no large demonstrations or movements in that direction, because they recognize that a rapid increase in the population would jeopardize their own position as well, that this would be disruptive of the economy. It may bring in elements of violence or of welfare dependency that would be a burden on the government. So as far as I can see, both officially and in the general population in Israel, the right of return is simply not a realistic option at this time.
And just finally, New Zealand has recently increased the amount of aid they give to UNRWA. Do you think this could have a negative effect on the relationship with Israel?
Probably not. I think the Israelis recognize that UNRWA is there to stay. It's too large, and there's too many vested interests in it to try to change it, and they're probably fairly tolerant that the Israeli government would look at the New Zealand government's overall relationship, the trade relationship, the technology sales, the diplomacy, and so forth, and say, all right, New Zealand is not drastically different to any other government, and many other governments support UNRWA. They work with the Palestinians in various capacities, and that New Zealand doesn't really stand out in any particular way. And the Israeli government tries to make friends wherever it can, as any responsible government should do, and to overlook the disagreements and try to focus on the common ground and the mutual interests that they have. So I don't anticipate that any of these issues, the UN resolution, the opposition to settlements, the support of UNRWA, I don't think that this will have a major effect on the ongoing bilateral relationship between the Israeli and New Zealand governments.
Iridangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Yes, that was Associate Professor Stephen Hoadley. We'll be right back after a quick break with Ricardo Menendez-March from Auckland Action Against Poverty. But for now, here is Little Fluffy Clouds by The Orb.
Over the past few years, to the traditional sounds of an English summer, the drone of lawnmowers, the smack of leather on willow, has been added a new noise.
What were the skies like when you were young?
They went on forever. We lived in Arizona, and the skies always had little fluffy clouds in them, and they were long and clear, and there were lots of stars at night. And when it would rain, they were beautiful, the most beautiful skies, as a matter of fact. The sunsets were purple and red and yellow and on fire. The clouds would catch the colors everywhere. That's neat, because I used to look at them all the time when I was little. You don't see that. had little fluffy clouds in them, and they were long and clear, and there were lots of stars at night. And when it would rain, it would all turn. They were beautiful, the most beautiful skies, as a matter of fact. The sunsets were. Had little fluffy clouds in them, and they were long and clear, and there were lots of stars at night. And when it would rain, it would all turn. They were beautiful, the most beautiful skies, as a matter of fact. The sunsets were purple and red and yellow and on fire, and the clouds would catch the colors everywhere. That's it, neat, because I used to look at them all the time. You don't see that. You might still see it in the desert.
Tūrama is Auckland's new immersive inner-city festival of light, jam-packed with dazzling light installations, projections and interactive sculptures. But it's not just lights. Tūrama has performances, film, food, drink and music from the likes of Yokozuna and Ed Zicolo, turning Albert Park into a brilliant winter wonderland for one magical weekend. Tūrama Festival, July 26th to the 28th, Albert Park. And completely free to attend, thanks to Trustpower. Find out more at 95bfm.com.
Jungle Jambo, the biggest interactive drum show for kids. Be part of the tribe. Drum together to save the jungle in this fantastic family entertainment these school holidays. Jungle Jambo at the Herald Theatre, July 16th to the 20th. Get your tickets now from Ticketmaster.
Arcade Radio, Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand affiliated radio show.
When I'm in a New York state of mind.
Arcade Radio.
Show me that you're mine, girl. Alright.
For all that and a heavy dose of fine tracks, tune in to Arcade Radio. Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. with Mike, Jono, Eddie, Nat, and special guests every week. Arcade Radio. Only on 95BFM.
Welcome back to BFM. The government's healthy home standards, or some of them anyway, come into effect today and include a raft of changes covering insulation, heating and moisture control to improve conditions for renters. State Housing, managed by Housing New Zealand, has longer to comply with the standards. However, some groups are saying this will harm the health of their occupants. I spoke with Ricardo Menendez-March from Auckland Action Against Poverty about the standards and Housing New Zealand, first asking him what his thoughts on the new legislation were.
These were improved by the government, which required heating minimum requirements as well as ventilation. But those won't kick in until 2021, and for Housing New Zealand tenants until 2023, which is really unfortunate, because not only do these requirements not go far enough, but I see no justifiable reason to leave our most vulnerable families waiting for better home standards for longer.
And has the government given any reason for giving Housing New Zealand extra time to comply?
My understanding is that the reason the government has given is that their housing stock of Housing New Zealand is quite large, and therefore they should give themselves more time to get it upgraded. But the reality is that the government has the resources and has the money to improve its housing stock, and the people who would benefit the most from accessing proper insulation and proper ventilation so that kids don't get sick would be our public housing tenants. So it is really unfortunate that we're making our poorest wait the longest to have healthy homes.
Because what is the condition of New Zealand's state housing stock like?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of state houses that were built in the 20th century, they were designed to be heated by firewood, but the way that they've been retrofitted is that they've been given a really low energy efficient wall heater that doesn't really warm up the homes. And since they've started putting insulation, the downside to the insulation is that while it addresses some of the issues with heat, it does not address the issue with dampness, which is actually what is causing a lot of Housing New Zealand tenants to get asthma, to get respiratory diseases because of the humidity. And the insulation without proper ventilation and without proper, drying facilities can actually make all of those things worse. So this piecemeal approach is simply not working. We need to do far more work for our Housing New Zealand tenants.
And what sort of effect do you think we'll see from this delay for tenants?
We're going to continue seeing children dying from preventable respiratory diseases, as well as just ballooning healthcare costs. So this cost-cutting from the houses is actually leading to expenses in other areas of government.
And the new homes that are being added to the state housing stock, are they having to comply to higher standards?
The standards that these homes are being made to comply are not good enough compared to, you know, the things that families really need. They may have insulation and they may have a kitchen ventilator, but we need to amend the building code so that they have central heating, that they have skylights, that they have double glazed windows to actually keep up with the rest of the world. I mean, this is why people who come from places like in Europe are always really surprised about the quality of our homes, because they're made as though we live in a subtropical country when our weather is not subtropical in most parts.
Why are we so far behind? Because you make a good point there about other countries, you know, the central heating is kind of the norm, whereas we just don't have that there, and it seems to kind of be accepted almost.
I think it just boils down to years of neglect by ongoing governments who haven't really put in the effort to upgrade the Housing New Zealand stock, as well as amend the building code to ensure that we keep up with the rest of the world when it comes to housing standards. There is no justifiable reason for us lagging behind. We have the resources, we have the technology, and it's a matter of political will.
Because how big exactly is the housing stock? How many houses does the government have to improve?
Tens of thousands, but again, when it comes to retrofitting, some of these solutions are just as simple as introducing double glazed windows, installing energy efficient heat pumps. But ultimately, what also needs to be happening is just amending the building code, as I said, to ensure that the new stock, which currently the government is projected on building 6,400 new state homes in the next 4 years, is of much higher quality than it is currently being planned, so that they don't have to spend all this money retrofitting it to make them healthy.
So what is it like spending a winter in one of these state houses that was built in the 20th century? Do you have people coming to you and talking about the conditions?
Yeah, most of the people that we work with are Housing New Zealand tenants. Most of them come with really high energy bills due to the low energy efficient heaters that are provided. Many of them come with respiratory diseases. And I mean, I've been visiting Housing New Zealand homes just the last week, and I've just caught a chest infection, I think, just from spending too much time in these cold homes. I mean, some of these homes are 9 to 10 degrees inside the home. I mean, you know, it's only a couple of degrees difference from being outside, and so this is really not the conditions our children should be growing up in.
That was The Wire.
That certainly was The Wire for another Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke to us very, very quickly. I think our poll, the consensus was that they would, if you were in an uninsulated home, report your landlord, and you should. They have to comply. They've had 3 years to comply. Fair enough. Slap them with that fine, in my opinion. Anyway, up next is Penny with the 1-4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.